The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Generation Rent calls for evictions ban as landlords evict tenants in unprecedented numbers. Outnumbered, what will the latest census results mean for Northern Ireland? And should I stay or should I go? Thánaiste says more people are returning to Ireland than emigrating. We'll have all of that and more on tonight's Late Debate. Joining us in studio tonight, we have Fergus O'Dowd, Fine Gael TD for Louth and Chair of the Joint Oireachtas Committee on the Implementation of the Good Friday Agreement, Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin Senator and Party Spokesperson on Climate Justice, Michael Fitzmaurice, Independent TD for Roscommon South Galway, and Gerard Howland, Public Affairs Consultant and former Political Advisor. We want to hear from you as well, so get in touch. Text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate.rte. Now, the Labour voice today added its voice, the Labour Party, I should say, today added its voice to calls for a ban on evictions this winter, saying renters must have their questions answered by the Housing Minister in this year's budget. In the Dáil, Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty called for a refundable tax credit equivalent to 1 month's rent to put money back in renters' pockets, coupled with a ban on rent increases for the next 3 years. Here's a flavour of how Thánaiste Leo Varadkar responded to that.
If there are concessions for landlords in the budget, there should also be tax concessions for renters. That's what I said, and I stand over it. In relation to any specific decisions, there will be meetings today and all over the weekend to finalise the budget package. But what I would say to you, Deputy, and it's important that we're frank and honest with people about what's happening in our country, there are bigger trends at play here, not least demographics, not least the cost of building new housing. And north of the border, where your party has been in office now for a very long time, house prices have also gone up. They've gone up by 20% in 2 years, and rents are rising as well. And that's a place where there's a Sinn Féin housing minister and a Sinn Féin finance minister.
And that was Thánaiste Leo Varadkar responding to Piers Doherty in the Dáil today. Fergus, he wasn't really giving much away there. Do you expect substantial measures for people in this category, renters?
Well, I hope so. I think
in the budget.
I think he was very clear that he favours both supporting the people who are renting and also to try and keep landlords in the marketplace, because a number of landlords have.
Well, he said if one thing was done, the other thing would also be done. But he didn't say either thing would, or he wasn't giving any indication.
But he wasn't. I would say he was. I thought he was quite clear that if one would happen, both would.
But the
reality, the if will become a reality. When the budget, we'll see what's in it.
Sorry to speak over you momentarily there, but we've heard so many kites and seen so much, predictions and promises around the budget now. But it's been remarkably silent on this issue of renters. I haven't heard much kind of indications of what might be there for renters.
Yeah, well, to me, it's clear that they need support. I have no issue with that. I'm not the Minister of Finance, and whatever is in the budget, we'll know within a week.
Well,
so I would certainly be happy to speak up for people who are renting. I think that would be very important that they would get that support.
What kind of support? The Labour Party says we need to ban evictions now.
Yeah, well, I think I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. There are a couple of issues. If somebody is actually dealing with drugs or very serious and significant adverse antisocial behaviour, they would be issues that I think, would have to be considered. That is a real issue in some areas, but the vast majority of people, wouldn't be in that category. So I don't have a problem at all with banning evictions, absolutely.
You have no problem with banning evictions? Would that
be absolutely
fair
not.
In Fine Gael?
Well, Katie, you're asking me questions and I'm giving you the answer that I can give you.
I'm surprised to hear you saying that, because I would have thought that there would have been. I haven't heard that from any of your colleagues.
Well, you're hearing it from me. And for the record, I'm not a landlord. I own my own house with my wife. We spent, like everybody else, 40 years buying it. People in Fine Gael that I know would agree with what I'm saying, but like everybody speaks for themselves. And I mean, there's a lot you talk about commentary. Everybody's commenting in the budget. There's lots of kites being flown. And the one we were waiting to see, obviously, and I think the Thánaiste challenge today, we'd like to see the Sinn Féin budget, what they're actually proposing, because We'd like to see what they're saying as well.
Yeah, and we're expecting that tomorrow, Lynn, are we?
Tomorrow, yeah. So yeah,
good stuff.
I won't steal Pearce's and Mairead's thunder, but there will be measures for renters. And we did launch the housing budget proposals already. But one of the things is because renters are seeing massive increases. And so we do need the ban on evictions to stem the flow of homelessness. Mm. But we also need a ban on rent increases. So one of our proposals is to stop any rent increases for 3 years and then to give renters the tax break. So the refundable tax credit of 1 month's rent. And what we're doing in this year's budget is giving 3 months to bring people up to the end of the year a tax credit and then 12 months in the following year because renters absolutely need a break. They really, really do.
You are a renter yourself, are you?
I'm a renter, yeah. Yeah.
I just, the figures, threshold, as you know, were before the Housing Committee earlier this week. The figures are really quite stark. Threshold has supported on average 462 private renters a month. That's 462 a month this year who have received notice of termination from their landlord. 6 out of 10 of those because the landlord was selling the property. And that is up from in 2019, pre-COVID, they were looking at, they were assisting 263 a month, half of them because the house was being sold or the apartment was being sold. That is a scary acceleration of something that is going to leave us with very little rent stock.
I think there's a few sides to this, Katie. I think smaller landlords, say the what we call accident landlords or people with one or two houses, they're running from the market. That's the first thing. I think the budget needs to do something for them, but I don't think they need to do anything for these big conglomerates that come in. You know, we need to start nailing them from outside Ireland that are buying up large amounts of property and renting it out. I think that they should be dealt with in a totally different way compared with the person that has, be it one house and renting it out. It's a totally different ballgame. Second of all, I think that there's another angle that should be looked at. That's the central bank. At the moment, if you go for a mortgage, the rent that you paid isn't worth a damn to you. They don't even allow for it. The central bank needs to step up to the mark as well. Thirdly, in relation to if a person is paying their rent and there's no good reason to be selling a house, then it shouldn't be allowed to be sold. But we have to be careful that if there was a difficult...
But you're not suggesting you can't sell a house.
That's what I'm saying.
You're not allowed to sell the house.
No, I says if a person was paying their rent, there's no good reason why a person should be evicted from a house. But if someone genuinely needs to sell a house, or if there was a problem, as Fergus outlined, with the tenant, well, then we have to be careful in that. But we need to make sure...
Are you in favour of, if we go through the various options we were talking about there, Labour saying, and you're supporting this as well, a ban on evictions?
Well, you have to be careful in what you say on a ban on evictions. Right, if someone wants to sell a house, are we going to basically put them in a way that they cannot sell it, right? And I think that would be dangerous ground legally. On top of that, if someone, for some reason, Fergus outlined it there, be it that there was a problem, that there was drugs or whatever, even the councils have a right to get harder on that at the moment. Yeah. So you have to have that. But if there's someone just deciding to let on they're selling the house or putting out someone for the sake of trying to get higher rent, that shouldn't be tolerated and should never be tolerated.
I see now, and I'll put this back to you actually, Lynn, because we're getting in. Katie, landlords are leaving the market every day because they see all their rights disappearing and the law becoming a bad tenant's charter. Anyone who stays in the landlord game is a mug. With Sinn Féin's ban on eviction, says another texter, would that also apply to antisocial behaviour by tenants or where tenants refuse to pay rent over a few months? And a third one says, Katie, it's communist talk of eviction bans and tenants organising that is driving landlords out of the market for fear of losing control of their own property. Okay. Isn't that something that needs to be considered when you're calling for these measures?
There's a number of inflammatory remarks there in that message. One is that even when we had the eviction ban during the lockdown, there was always the exception made for if a person was willfully not paying their rent or for antisocial behaviour. So no one is saying that would be removed. That would continue with an eviction ban. For someone to say an eviction ban is communism, France has always banned evictions during the winter. It has always had that. Scotland has just announced an eviction ban over the winter. So what you're calling for is a temporary eviction ban because we are facing a tsunami of families who are going to be made homeless because their houses are being sold from under them where they're renting. And we have nowhere to put those families because the emergency accommodation is crippled. So you have to do something as an emergency measure to stop that flow of families becoming homeless. And one of the other measures in our budget is that we would provide the funding then for the councils to buy some of those properties from the landlord. So if they have tenants who are on the HAP scheme or the RAS scheme or those various schemes, their local authority, they're eligible for social housing, that the council should be able to buy some of those properties.
The only one thing I'd say there I listened to Owen, the other half, talk on one day, and I listened with interest because he has a lot of ideas on housing. And I was listening to the budgets that you'd be talking about. The government won't be in a position to buy every house that you want to buy. You know, there is certain budgets that have to go by. And going by the number of houses, and this is on a debate, and I'm open to contradiction, but the difference over a five-year period of being Sinn Féin in government or whoever is in government, and this isn't politics that I'm talking about, that there wasn't a whole lot of difference when you add up the brownfield sites and the greenfield sites and the houses that you'd buy in the budgets. So I don't know how you'd keep buying every house that you'd be dreaming.
Nobody said you're buying every house. That's the point. You're buying some measures. So Owen Murphy, when he was the minister, he stopped local authorities purchasing houses that had tenants in them. And then Dara O'Brien has reintroduced it, but he has put so much red tape in the place that it's actually, it's very ineffective. So you need to do is facilitate local authorities to buy those houses.
Gerard, who's slightly late arriving, so you're a little late to the party. You might have missed Fergus O'Dowd here surprising
Sorry, Fergus.
Me.
How are you?
Surprising me by saying that he too supports the idea of a rent or evictions ban for the rent.
Well, there's lots of good reasons for an evictions ban, and you know, they do operate in other countries. There's also a cost, and so long as we're clear about the cost, we can proceed eyes wide open. And the cost is, for example, property generally, including houses that are mortgaged. You effectively cannot evict anyone now to the courts for not paying a mortgage. Housing, mortgaged housing has become an illiquid asset, de facto. If you move then to extend that to rented housing, what happens is that there is a cost that is socialised more widely. It's a contributory factor, and I know we're talking about rented property, it's a contributory factor, among others, to a higher cost of mortgages in this country than in others. Going back to the rented property, of course, what happens is, for landlords who have options, i.e. they have more than one property, and insofar as they can spread what they perceive as the cost, they will burden others with that. That's how it works. So long as you're happy with that, go ahead.
I think the key point is what is socially just and fair, and I agree with what Lynn is saying, is that if a family are paying their rent, and particularly in a winter period, I think they should be able to stay in that house.
I'm not saying that's unfair. I'm saying there's a cost.
I accept you saying that. I'm not disagreeing with you.
But there's a huge social cost.
What I'm trying to say is that families should not, if they're paying the rent and it's been met, and if there are no antisocial issues, and I'm talking about drug sales and stuff like that, I think they should be secure in that home. And I do know personally of people who had to leave a home on the basis that it was being sold, when in actual fact it wasn't, as it turned out at the end of the day.
And that's
also going on. So I think let's be reasonable about this. Let's be serious about it. And the other point is, by building the number of homes we're building at the moment, and I think that in the last 12 months, from August to August, there was 24,000 homes built fully and 28,000 other houses started on. And I think the only way we'll deal with this issue at the end of the day is build more homes. And that's what we're doing. And I think the government is doing extremely well on that right now.
Threshold, obviously, make the same point, that the only the large-scale provision of social, affordable and cost rental housing will improve matters for those reliant on the private rental sector. But, they say, until such time that there are sufficient homes in the system, it will be necessary for the government to take targeted measures. And some of those, the reintroduction of tax relief for private renters. That should be...
I don't have a problem with that.
That should be a no-brainer.
Yeah,
I would have thought it was there up until 2010. It was taken out of the system after the crash.
And there are significant supports as well.
It should be there. But there's another part of this as well, Katie, that no one talks about. You look at the threshold that there is in Dublin to get on the council housing list. But if you go down to Bede Roscommon, you have like 26,000, 300 or 400 or 500 is all you can earn. Well, houses have increased in every part of the country. And even go to Galway, or go around the different, like we have a totally, I think, a lopsided system that depending on what county you're in, to get on the council list or to get HAP, for that matter, you're on a totally, there's totally different figures in most counties. And we need to start realising that not alone it's Dublin or Cork or Limerick or Galway, but it's the Drogheda's and it's the Killarney's and it's the Innes's and it's the, you know,
the ability
smaller
to
towns
local
or the Roscommons of this world that needs that threshold risen up in every county. And that's not being done. It has been done in 5 counties in the last week, but there's a lot of counties
You have to rent pressure zones. I live in a rent pressure zone, as sure most of us here do.
And well, every place in Ireland is a rent pressure zone now.
But that means that the limit of a rent increase to an existing tenant, and I stress an existing tenant, is 2%. And, you know, I welcome that, because before the rent pressure zones came in, there were increases of 14, 15, 18%, 20% in Drogheda before it became a rent pressure zone. So the government is tackling that.
But landlords and people representing property owners will say, and they were out this week making this very point, that if you have tenants in place for a number of years, you know, they were very good tenants, landlords would not have wanted to increase the rent to hang on to those tenants because they didn't need it, because maybe their mortgage was paid or whatever. They put that house on the market, which a lot of them are doing now because the prices are where they are.
Yeah,
there is no incentive whatsoever in the system for that, for another investor to come along and buy that property and keep it in the rental market, because they can only add another 2%. And if you are way, way below market rent at that point, no investor is going to look at that as a viable prospect. That is something surely that should be looked at. If we are seeing the kind of reduction in the housing stock of rental properties.
Well, obviously some it's an attractive option, because if you look at this week, there was a big amount of apartments, I think, in the south side of Dublin, a deal done on them. And I think
you're conflating two things. These are people with a wall of money looking for somewhere to stay. We're talking about regular investors who would be looking after their tenants.
I said, if you talk about what I call incidental landlords, and that's going from the market in large numbers, they're walking away from it. And unless we in the budget bring in an incentive to keep them, at the moment, everything there is 50% gone. That's the reality.
Can I ask you? Look, I'll just try to get a few of the things we're coming in here. Now, I have somebody saying they don't believe for a second that small landlords are exiting the market at the levels being reported. Heard numerous cases, as you reported there, of people being evicted using the excuse of selling up, only to discover some landlords are advertising at higher rents. Now, I do think if you talk to estate agents, they will tell you that there is a lot of these properties going on sale. I have one here. I'm an ex-landlord and just sold. This texter said they just sold 2 houses housing 8 people. I sold for the very reason Sinn Féin will crucify the landlords when they get into power. Glad I left now, said Paul in Cork. And then I have another final one here. David in Waterford said, Katie, these landlords want to get a grip of themselves. They hate tenants' rights because they can't treat them as poorly as they always have. I'd take out my violin, but the string on it broke from overplaying hearing about poor landlords, says David. But that point about people are nervous about what Sinn Féin is talking about in relation to, you know, eviction bans and rent increase bans. And
we have a housing crisis, though, Katie.
What are you proposing to entice the Pauls to hang on to their property or entice other Pauls to come
One
back
is that we have a huge amount of people who are in the private rental sector who should be in social housing or affordable rental or affordable purchase. they shouldn't be in the private rental sector. Now, that's saying that some people will choose to always be renters, but there is a huge cohort of people, and that's because there isn't a supply of those type of houses. So, like, the government delivered 700 of its 9,000 target of social housing, 300 affordable rental, 300 affordable purchase. That's not going to go anywhere near providing for those families who are in private rental market who shouldn't be there. So our private rental
sector
is too big.
Just in relation to the private rental market.
But a lot of the people who, as we've heard, the accidental landlords or the people who invest in property or pension, there's nothing you can do really to incentivise them to stay because they are leaving because the property market is at a high. So, I mean, they never wanted to be landlords and they rented out their property because they were negative equity and they moved into a bigger house or they were renting. They're selling up now because property prices are so high. You have others who were pension pot landlords. Yeah. They're coming to an age now where they're cashing in that pension pot.
But so other people are not stepping in to take their place because they don't see the market. They don't see that as a viable business now.
Is that something
that should be concerning?
But you need the states to take a more proactive role in providing housing for people.
Need a private rental sector?
Of course you'll always need a private rental sector. But we have the problem is that from the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael governments for the last number of decades have outsourced the service of providing housing to the private market, and now we're paying the price for that. The state needs to step in, needs to take people who shouldn't be in the private rental sector out of it, who should be in affordable rental, affordable purchase and
social
housing.
Am I right in saying though that you don't have any specific proposals for in terms of the tax considerations or in terms of that issue that has emerged about, rental properties not being viable businesses for anybody?
Well, I think we were on the record constantly of saying that it's completely unfair that you have large institutional investors who are paying very, very little tax and then you have small landlords who are paying more, and there needs to be an equalisation.
You need private investment.
But the issue is that those landlords who are leaving the market are going to leave the market anyway because their houses are at a high
price. We need to be
very
careful as well.
Because if you
look at people people out there working, they can't afford the price of a house at the moment with the way it is. And you know what? If you add it up and you'd say someone that's on 40 or 50 or 60K, say a husband or wife, and you'd say some people would say they're doing okay. When they pay everything, if they had to go for a mortgage, they were better off on a way less money and be on the social housing list than the way it's going at the moment.
I think
it's not paying
before we leave it,
Jared.
Look, we're years away from anything short of a lot of hardship in the housing market. I mean, eventually there will be a moment of catch up and rebalancing, and between then, there's only ways that are invariably painful of dividing too little among too many, and these are all just symptoms of that fundamental problem.
Okay, we'll move on because obviously this is our last late debate before the budget next week. Today, Finance Minister Pascal Dunne, or rather yesterday in an interview with the Irish Times, Pascal Dunne warned that we'll be poorer for longer if inflation gets embedded in the economy. He warned that next week's budget will have to strike a balance between helping those most impacted by the current crisis while avoiding adding to existing inflationary pressures. Now, this is ahead of a budget that will have a 6.7 billion core package and another 3 billion euro, we're hearing, for these once-off measures. Are you worried about inflation, Fergus?
We're all worried about inflation because it's up near 10% now. We're all worried about the war in Russia. We're all worried about the price of energy. I don't know anybody who isn't worried about their next ESB or their gas bill. Yes, we are worried. The government are worried. And it's important that we respond to that worry by supporting, first of all, people who are weakest, who need the most heat, who have the least income to pay for it, people who are sick, people who are pensioners, people who have disabilities. We must look after those, and we must make sure, I believe we should extend the fuel scheme to include more people on a higher income than is presently allowed. I think we should increase to 33 euros. I think that's what the government is about. It's about supporting those who need it most and must get it. And the other point is that older people that I know, some of them are afraid to turn on their heating because they think they won't be able to afford to pay for it. So that's why the government, in terms of what it did earlier this year, by giving a lump sum to people who, in terms of their their energy bills. I think that is very, very important that that's done again. Plus,
and give it to everyone, no matter what. Even if you've got the two Range Rovers in the front driveway, you'll get the three energy credits again.
There are lots of people who might have two Range Rovers. I don't know anybody myself personally who has.
Of course you don't.
No, I don't actually. I don't. I'm not into Range Rovers, actually.
You don't hang in those circles.
I'm sorry to disappoint you in that. But what I do know is that the average income, if I'm on 40 or 50,000 a year, and if I have a mortgage, I have to pay my childcare, I have to pay my taxes on my car, I have to drive my car. So I do not accept the argument, implicit or implied, I'm not saying you're saying it, is that people who are on a wage of 40, 50,000 shouldn't get support. Of course they should.
And yeah, could but I if you're on wages of 100,000 or 200,000, you'll also get support.
May I make another point that a person I was talking to yesterday, they got a nice bill from their mortgage provider. They're now going to pay €110 a month more. And they can't pay it because they don't have that money. So what's going to happen to them? They can't pay their energy bill. So what the government has to do is look after everybody. I said the poorest, the weakest, the sickest.
And the richest.
I'm not finished. It must also look after those who are in middle income. Yes, it must. But it must also give more money to people in their pockets that are working so they can pay for these increases also.
Gerard Holland, you're very critical of the kind of kites we've been looking at over the last number of weeks now.
Yeah, well, there's astronomical spending being promised, and 2023 will be the fourth year in a row in which this country has failed to provide a budget that lasts us through the year. This budget, we are being told, will not provide for special measures next winter, notwithstanding the fact that we know that next winter will probably, unfortunately, be another serious episode of an energy crisis as well. So there's little prospect, in fact, that the budget, whatever it says this day week, will provide, or next Tuesday, I should say, excuse me, will provide for the full year, and there won't be a subsequent budget, as there has been every year for 4 years in a row. That's hugely important in terms of discipline. It's not an issue of how much is spent. It's an issue of how much is spent versus our tax base, the affordability of that amount of money. And we know that our tax base is not stable or secure. We know that for different reasons, an insecure tax base is one of the two main contributory causes to an economic crash post 2008. And speaking of the poorest, there is no hardship to be visited more viciously on the poorest than a state that has to suddenly contain spending when in that shock situation, the only thing that can be contained quickly is current spending on which the poorest are most dependent.
Now, Pascal Dunne will say that he's very, very cognizant of the
nature of
particularly those corporate tax receipts and the fact that we have this big ball of money now that will be, he says, kept for these once-off measures.
OK, so I know what he says. What he does as Minister of Finance over years, with his partners in government, and there's little difference, by the way, between the parties in government on spending and the main opposition party, Sinn Féin. They try to make differences between themselves, but effectively they're all united on a big spending platforms of various kinds and a refusal to cognize the fact that our tax base isn't up to the bigger state that we're spending. If you go to the conversation we've had in this room in the last few minutes, the bigger state is being built all the time, all of it good stuff, all of it with a cost, and none of the three public representatives who have an electoral mandate have spoken or mentioned at all about the taxes that will be needed to support the good ideas they're bringing out. This is not sustainable. This is cruising for a bruising. And if a downturn comes, the problem will be it is the poorest, most dependent on current spending. It will be hit hardest and first, and we know that because that is what happened post 2008.
Lynn?
I don't think the comparison between now and 2008 stacks up. What we're focusing on in the budget, and as I said, it'll all be laid out tomorrow by Pearson Mairead, but it is around tackling what is causing the inflation, and that is the cost of energy is the primary driver of inflation at the moment, and then you have the cost of rent and housing and the cost of childcare, and they're three of our big ticket items that we want to bring down those costs for people.
Do you accept, though, that when it comes to that, the biggest of those three big ticket items, energy, it's largely out of our control, no matter what you say.
Well, there absolutely, there's geopolitical issues at stake. I mean, there's a lot that we can do in terms of bringing down the cost of energy in this country, because, I mean, if we go back to when we liberalised our electricity market, we went from having the cheapest electricity and having price controls to having the most expensive electricity. And we still continue to have very, very expensive electricity. Even our renewables, which were in a very fortunate position to have a lot of wind, a lot of access to solar, it's more expensive than every other European country. So there are things we can do structurally to bring down the cost of energy. But the issue of the emergency electricity cap is one that brings certainty to households and to businesses, that they can at least know that they're going into the winter and the bills will be more or less around what they were last year.
But it brings uncertainty to the government finances. Surely that has to be a consideration.
Well, it's a temporary measure, and then it is also coincides with the windfall tax and arguing for the reform at the EU level as well around the decoupling of renewables and gas. So it's a suite of measures, but it's happening, and I mean it's happening in lots of European countries.
But the Fiscal Advisory Council, which you were very quick to quote if it suits your political policy agenda, are very, very clear about this. They say it's a very risky strategy, would be a very risky strategy to go down that road.
But it's a very risky strategy that the Netherlands, France, Austria, the Czech Republic, Poland, Denmark, Slovakia and Romania have gone down, because they appreciate the fact that we are in a short-term crisis with energy. We need to be bringing on our renewables as fast as possible. But we have a couple of years now of very dark winters ahead, and it's up to the state to step in and give families and small businesses that sense of security.
Fergus, just before you speak, we've got a tweet here. Is Fergus O'Dowd sure he's in the right party? He's not a landlord. He doesn't know anyone with a Range Rover. Doesn't sound like a great fit for Finnegan.
You said two Range Rovers. Sorry,
you've
never thought of...
You do know people with the single Range Rover.
I don't know with one, but not with two. No, unless you have two, have you? I don't.
I shouldn't be making light.
No, but let's be
clear on
this.
In terms of the energy cap, because...
Of course,
It's a policy that's not just Sinn Féin, but right across the opposition. They say this is what we should do, because you either give, you know, the people should have that certainty and businesses should have that certainty going through.
The Taoiseach hasn't ruled it out. He didn't rule it out today.
They more or less have, though, haven't they? They've given very strong hints that they're not going down that road.
If you read what he actually said, he hasn't ruled it out, but he sees serious issues with it. But he did say, I know, George, you wouldn't have heard this morning, but he did say the energy supports will continue into next year. He actually said that. I heard him say that.
Yeah. But I also heard the other ministers say that in terms of the special provisions that are going to be provided in this positive 3 billion, there's no replication of that for next year.
Sure.
So my question is, if we have another winter like this or half like this, where are the special measures if they're not provided for in the budget?
Right, well, fair enough. That's a fair... I can't answer that now, but I do know what he said. And can I just make the point that the budget will be next week. We'll have greater clarity on these. But what we don't have clarity on is the cost of energy into the future. Because when you look at what Putin is saying, this war could turn into a nuclear war. God knows what it could turn into. So there's no certainty at all about the price of energy and how it's going to be, how it could expand exponentially. We don't know. So the government has to look at this issue, and I believe that they must be prudent initially. They have acted earlier this year by supporting families, and they will definitely be supporting families next week.
But obviously, in the new year, the 200 euro credit that was given in last year's the untargeted measure, a lot of the traveller community didn't receive that 200 euro payment. There was a 20 million euro underspend on it. And when it was made aware to the government that the traveller community weren't getting their rebate, the 200 euro, we use that 20 million euro to buy
Sinn Féin, you attacked your party and Sinn Féin attacked that, said it was wrong, blah, blah, blah. Guess what? Michelle O'Neill, have her on Twitter, went on to the same thing in the north. So let's be clear on this. If you're implying that there's discrimination against travellers, I would disagree with you. I don't know what happened, but anybody who had a meter, and I because I raised this, in fact, in the PQ, sometimes people, like in my own constituency, they live on a caravan site, you know, and there's only one meter, there's only one bill coming in to the owner of the site, and the people didn't get it. And I raised that with the ESB and I raised it with the government.
But the point is, it was raised with the minister.
They couldn't do anything about it.
They said they couldn't do anything.
So they're going to be in the same position.
The same position again.
They will be, yes. And I tried to get the figures, and I believe it's quite high nationally, but I don't have them.
But there was a 20 million euro underspend. So once that problem was identified, surely it wouldn't be beyond the rocket science to go in and identify a way of fixing that. Instead, we spent the 20 million on gas powered generators.
The problem is that they
were travellers without any
rebates. The only way to measure the electricity is on the unit as it comes in. And the other point is that it's a cheaper, it's actually a cheaper rate than the household rate. That's the other complication in it.
The Ferguson Inshaw. First of all, look at it. When you listen to what has been said, yeah, there is risks to doing a lot of stuff in the line of, you know, has been outlined. In 2008 or 9, I think we're 47 billion in debt. We are now 270. And there is risks down the line of the economy, which it probably won't, because some of our corporation tax isn't as solid as we think it is. But there's only one thing you have to do. There's a war on at the moment. A lot of stuff is outside our control. Oil and gas is basically outside our control. There's no point in we clasping at straws and say we'll solve something that way. But there's an onus on, while an economist will say one thing, there's an onus on a government and on politicians to make sure of one thing, that we keep the lights on, that we keep people warm, and basically that we keep food in our country. And them are the three crucial things, I believe, over the next 6, 8, 10, 12 months. And maybe we have to face a second winter of it. But if while we have to do that, in my opinion, we have to do it. And yes, there are risks. I don't deny that. But you have to, what do? You say, oh, well, geez, that mightn't happen. We mightn't get that money in next year, the year after, and let someone perish in their house? You can't do that. So you've got to make sure that the citizens of this country are protected.
Yes, but we have to find a balance between protecting those people and not spending the winter eating the seed potato, Michael. That never worked out well in the past. It's not the same as 2008. The conditions are completely different. But if there were a disturbance to the rate of corporation tax coming into the exchequer, if the public finances and public spending have to be adjusted, the burden will fall on the very same people, because we, focusing on one winter, didn't have to cop on to think of the year and the years ahead.
And I think that's what the budget has to account for. And that's why the Rainy Day Fund has to get income from this budget as well. And I mean, the government has to be prudent at all times. But it is listening. We're all listening. We all understand the problems. We deal with them the best we can. But we can't write a blank cheque, and we can't solve all the problems. I'm getting businesses that their energy bills have tripled. I'm getting shops that are going to have to close. I'm getting factories employing 140 people. One of them, he's going to have to go
on
short
term. Fergus, I saw a thing coming out this evening. Yeah. I'm after reading it tonight about a grant for businesses up to so many kilowatts.
Yeah.
And it's 2,400. It's like peanuts to a monkey. If you listen to the bills, I don't know, in Roscommon, there was a bill of 20,000 for a month. And I know a lot of small businesses, especially food stores.
Yeah.
And say small rural shops, they are in serious trouble.
Of course they are.
And we don't make sure that we give them the incentive to spend, as well as low-cost loans, that should be brought forward.
And grants. They're talking about grants,
But I'm looking at what they're offered in 2,400. If you need 20 kilowatts to put up in solar panels, the outlay is going to be serious. So you need to bring a combination of solutions the way that they will survive, because they won't survive.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to give another couple of lines, and I need to take, we have a couple of breaks now, and I need to go to the first one. But before we go, just this one. Listening to your show and talk about bringing down the cost of energy makes me very angry. Why didn't our Green Minister promote offshore wind when he was Minister for Energy 10 years ago? We are getting what we deserve for our stupidity and inaction, and all politicians are guilty, including independents, says Paul and Kerry.
We have no port in Southern Ireland that can take the gear that you need to bring the turbines and stuff out to sea. That's the first thing. We have one in Northern Ireland. We have none in Southern Ireland. So until we get them right, there's no point. And like I've said this time and time again in your programme, and I've called Ryan out on this, in my opinion, to be 2030, 2032, before we'd be ready to do this. And we're dreaming a dream about all that offshore wind. We have to rely on gas and fossil fuels for the time being. And I'd say in rural Ireland, we're lucky we have our bit of turf.
I'll take a break.
Yep.
The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
Just before we leave the energy discussion, this moratorium on disconnection, what happens if you have a pay-as-you-go meter? Is there how is that going to work? And often people who would be in the worst circumstances would be relying on those meters.
I think the mandate not to cut off applies to every private supplier. Yeah. So I don't know the nuts and bolts of it if you're a pay-as-you-go.
Yeah,
but you cannot be cut off. That's the rule anyway.
The problem is that a lot of people on pay-as-you-go are self-disconnecting. And it's very concerning that CRU doesn't collect the data on that. So if you get a look in Britain, Ofgem would collect the data and would be able to intervene if they notice that somebody is self-disconnecting. CRU are not monitoring that to the same level. So that is concerning because the people are be falling through the gaps. But the disconnections moratorium has been extended from 1 month to 3 months. And the financial hardship meter, I think it's 6 months they've extended that to. But there's an awful lot more that the energy regulator could be doing.
And in terms of the energy regulator, and Micheál Martin was asked about this in New York today. These increases in standing charges. I mean, obviously we all understand why unit charges are flying up. But when you see standing charges going up at the rate that they are going up as well, you would have to
There's no transparency about it.
And the CRU have absolutely, the regulator has apparently absolutely no power to intervene in any way, even in relation to standing.
We hear it's an excuse. The excuse being used is because these generators are coming in next year.
What the CRU told the Oireachtas Committee on Tuesday was they need regulation change. So it is now up to Minister Ryan to do that regulation change and to tackle the standing
And do
charges.
They want that power? Does the CRU want the power to be able to intervene in relation to
My impression of the CRU when they come before the committee is that they don't want to interfere in the market at all and argue constantly against interfering in the market. And I find that concerning.
I think one thing,
but the remit can be changed with the CRU. I mean, is in the gift of the
I think
the
one thing that needs to be said, Katie, is for people out there, this week it was announced that there's another company leaving the market. Mm. And we have seen when Iberdrola left the market and didn't give notice, there was 30,000 customers that were tied in to huge high rates because they automatically went on to Electric Ireland or Bord Gas, and they had no say in the matter, to be quite frank.
But they weren't given the new attractive rates.
They couldn't get the new attractive rate for 3 months, just 1 second. Yeah, yeah. But there's 2 weeks until the end of this month, and anybody out there that they've got the notice about it, they need to make a decision, in my opinion, fairly quick, or they will be caught in the same scenario of a 3 month lock in with either Electric Ireland.
Here's the frightening bit about Iberdrola and Panda, I think it was, that went to the wall.
That's right, yeah.
When they leave the market, the ESB has to pick up the slack and be the supplier of last resort. They haven't factored those customers in, so they won't have bought the gas generation. So that increases the cost for Electric Ireland customers overall. And I asked the CRU this on Tuesday, what is happening? Because Iberdrola walked away, washed their hands with it. They left workers behind. They're a very profitable company in Spain. And the CRU, I asked them, should we be looking at following them up and trying to recoup some of that money so that Electric Ireland customers aren't then paying for the fact that these companies come in and then just walk away with no repercussions?
The only one thing I'd say to that, Lynn, is that I don't buy into the CRU, what they've said to you, for the simple reason, if I move inside the next, before the end of the month, I can get a deal. So if they're talking about, well, they had to go on to the Electric Ireland and they hadn't factored this in, how is it someone else is able to give me a deal
because,
and they cannot?
Because you, if you stay, if you don't switch around, you fall onto a default tariff, which penalises you in exactly the same way that insurance companies penalise
you
when you don't switch
every
around,
year, basically,
which is deeply unfair to people who don't have the capacity to switch.
There's one other point. There's 1 million smart meters installed in homes which help people get the lowest rate and for them. And only, I think, 39,000 of them are in use.
People have no idea how they work.
Yeah, and they haven't been informed.
And they haven't been told.
One thing, I
know that the regulator was on prime time explaining this
and was generating extra electricity.
Yeah.
And the electricity went out off on the grid. You cannot generate then. Which means that basically the units you bought are no good to you.
Okay. Quick one before we go to that census in Northern Ireland. Richard Boyd-Barrett brought this up. This came up again. It has come up a number of times in the last number of weeks. This survey from the National Youth Council of Ireland Red Sea survey saying that 70% of young people aged between 18 and 24 are considering moving abroad for a better quality of life. This was brought up by Richard Boyd-Barrett in The Dáil today, and the Dáil Minister responded by saying that there wasn't an outflow of people from the country. The reverse is the case. He said the population increased by 89,000 last year, and that included more Irish citizens returning to Ireland than were leaving.
Yeah, well,
Fergus, do you completely reject that idea that there are young people who are thinking of immigrating now?
You can't argue with the facts. The facts are that the population has gone up. What age those people are, I don't know. And if it's a fact that the stats say that there are a lot more Irish people coming back, that is a fact also.
Do you talk to people out there? Do they tell you that?
I talk to people every day, every day in my office.
And you haven't heard this?
I have, of course.
Drumbeat for young people.
I think the point is that just on Ireland, for facts, unemployment is 4.3%. It's the lowest it's been in a long, long time. There are 2.55 million people working in this country, the highest number ever. Our economy is in a surplus right now, thanks be to God. We have a surplus of 6 million. A year ago, we had a negative of 6 million.
So this is not if it's an economic issue,
this country's doing very well. But obviously, young people, my own family, some of my children have emigrated. Half my family, when I was young, emigrated as well. So I'm not saying they're not emigrating, but there are lots of good things happening in this country. A lot of young people working in the industry, you know, the technology, the new technology. It's a vibrant, lively country. But we would love to keep more young people here. And we are creating jobs to keep them
here. Was there ever a time when people of that age didn't want to get up and go? I can certainly wanted to do it myself. I did it. It was the 1980s.
Yeah.
There was 18% unemployment. So I think at that age,
there was a driving factor
to get up and go and have a bit of experience.
But we're now talking about people. Yeah, we're talking about that age group in particular from that survey. But certainly anecdotally, you're hearing people in their heading towards 30, early 30s, looking at their prospects and saying, There's a major issue in the almost
full employment economy that Fergus has accurately described, of people not having opportunity equal to their attainment in employment and education. That's a huge factor. And houselessness is part of that.
I know the housing crisis is the key driver of it. I mean, I know people who have left the country who had really good jobs, and they left because they got their notice to quit, and they just went, I can't face trying to even find somewhere in this country to live, and they're gone to London and gone abroad.
But the country is really tragic.
If people want to go up and try travelling or move abroad for different opportunities, is one thing. But if you're leaving, not because you can't find work, you have a job that you love, but because you can't put a roof over your head, that's really, really tragic.
It's a huge issue.
Shane Roscommon, like you're from a part of the country, Michael, where traditionally there would have been a big clear out in the 50s.
Yeah.
The 70s, the 80s, and again after the crash.
There was, it's actually in the 80s, I remember a huge exodus of people because there was no work. The country was in a serious state. Mm-hmm. But the people I see going now, and there are people going,
of course,
the reason they're going is that they cannot see themselves, while they have a job, there's no problem about getting a job, while they cannot ever see themselves getting to a stage where they would be able to afford a house, do childcare, rear a family. And that's what's nagging them at the moment. And that's the problem.
Well, childcare,
there's no work. There is
childcare is a
work.
Huge issue. And that's why the government, I think, are committed to having childcare costs. So hopefully it'll be something significant.
You will be looking out
budget.
For that for sure. There's
Please
big,
do, yeah, because
promises,
I'll be looking out for it as well.
Big promises made on that front. Okay.
And I think, you know, I would say that is a genuine point that I'm making. And I am looking out for it, I'm sure.
Okay. I'm not doubting your sincerity on that front, Fergus. Okay. I want to touch now on that census in the north, in Northern Ireland. First time in its 101-year history that Northern Ireland that Catholics, there are more Catholics than Protestants. And I think more interesting, though, in that really are the numbers of people identifying So national identity, the numbers who said they have a British only identity has fallen from 40% to 32%, while those who regard themselves as Irish only is up 4 points to 29% in just the space of 5 years. When you look at those numbers, though, like 20, what are we looking at there? 29 and 32. There's now a very, you can see why the Alliance are doing so well in elections up there, Lynn, can't you?
Well, I think for us, I mean, you're looking at it that it is an opportunity to convince that cohort of people and to reach
who
out
are
to
now
them,
non-aligned.
Who are non-aligned and to make the case and make the argument, and those of us who are advocating for a referendum on a United Ireland, to convince them. And that's, and I think that that's really interesting and exciting that there's that number of people who are out there who are, was open to being convinced, and we have to convince them that you know, a United Ireland is in their interests. So, I mean, for us, the census it's a seismic shift in the state.
Yeah, it was never supposed to happen.
It was never supposed to happen. It was designed to not happen. But I do think it's really exciting, because there is that cohort of people who could be convinced that they would be better off in a United Ireland.
There's about 40% of people who are not fully aligned to either one or the other, and the degree of not aligned, of course, changes a lot across that 40% spectrum. There's almost aligned, completely unaligned, and every shade in between. The last union lasted 121 years. It is questionable whether this union will last that long. There's an ongoing demographic change over decades that has been hugely accelerated and jolted by Brexit. The deepest damage to the union, from a unionist perspective, has been Brexit and the DUP. It's an astonishing thing. The other thing, by the way, is cultural change is very significant in Northern Ireland. We're talking about these labels, Catholic and Protestant. There's very little practice nowadays of either of those values compared to the past. It's a much less religious practicing culture.
And I saw a commentator today arguing, I think it might have been Amanda Ferguson, actually, the journalist Amanda Ferguson, asked whether, you know, why don't they ask the question practicing Catholic or practicing Protestant? Because, as you say, it's a kind of a cultural tag rather than a thing in many cases. Yeah. And they basically said that's up to the politicians to design. We just ask the questions we're told to ask. Fergus, what do you make from it?
I think it's very interesting. It's historic in that respect. I think that obviously the whole idea of Northern Ireland as a state initially was a Protestant state for a Protestant people, according to Mr. Craig, who was there at the time. Our job now, I think, in the South, I'm in favour of a border poll at the appropriate time. I think what we need to do is to set out our stall that will attract in not just the middle ground, but if we're going to have a United Ireland, unionists must buy into it. So we have to find a way that will embrace their identity, which the Good Friday Agreement does, and their entitlements and their historic attraction to the UK and so on. So I think it's not just as simple as having a border poll.
When do you expect that poll? When do you think
the Good Friday Agreement is that the Secretary of State of Northern Ireland looks into his or her heart and they decide it. That was the error in the Good Friday Agreement. It isn't set out how you do it. But it is clear that if he forms or she forms the opinion that there's a majority for it, I presume by public surveys and so on, then he would have a poll. But if you have a poll and you lose it,
it's very damaging in itself.
Yeah. This thing of a border poll, eventually there will be one.
Yeah,
but to do it prematurely, to have any hint that you're trying to substitute one majoritarianism for another, to not understand that it's ultimately about a union of people.
But do you think the border poll, I mean, the outcome of that, there could be very many constitutional arrangements to accommodate what might come out of that, surely. We can't just assume we're going for,
you know. But the problem is, you're jumping off the edge of the cliff, because I couldn't name one constitutional arrangement to follow a border poll that is on the table for serious consideration.
But it's one of the reasons why we're calling for a citizens' assembly
and that's
on
the
United Ireland to look at all of those opportunities.
I'm chairman of the Rochdale's Committee, which unionists are entitled to attend and speak. They won't come. They won't speak to us. They meet us privately. If we're going to have a United Ireland, I favour that. They have to embrace whatever future is going to be, and we have to recognise all their needs. So we have to plan it and plot it, and they must buy into it, because you can't have a new Catholic state for a Catholic people either. Or a Republican state for a Republican people.
Sinn Féin would say the United Ireland we want is just not tacking the six counties onto the 26.
John Hughes his vision of a shared future, a shared Ireland. And that's where we have to go. And that's why I think all of us should put together our thinking caps. You're right, Jared. Put our plans out there. Discuss them.
We're a long way from
it. Absolutely. We're a long way from it. But we're starting on the road. But we can only start with, and we can only get to the end if we get consent.
The one thing we have to be careful of is that we don't peeve people off. Talking about something without, as what Jared says, having plans or having it out on the table there to accommodate everybody. Mm-hmm. And unless we do that and do it right,
this could
turn out something that could be dangerous, to be quite frank about it.
I actually don't know anybody who's calling for a border poll overnight and to just do it like that. In fact, we're calling for having the Citizens' Assembly, having the you've got Ireland for Ireland's Future, that organisation as well. There's all different organisations who are planning and organising. What we need is the government to step in now and start that part as well.
We need the unionists.
And I need to take my last break.
Email latedebate@rte.ie.